Oh, it's a pig! Welcome to the Lake Erie Kayak Anglers Podcast, the podcast designed to make you a better angler. I'm Chuck Earls with LakeErieKayakFishing.com. Today we have Devin Brewer joining us. Devin is an angler, but that's not why he's joining the show today. I met Devin Friday, June 10th, when your jet ski was sinking. So,
yes, sir.
We'll get into that story a little bit. But first, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I pretty much grew up within 5-10 miles of Lake Erie for my whole life, as far as, you know, the lake goes. Really didn't start getting out on the lake until I was 17, 18 years old, got my boater's license, picked up an old boat, old outboard, we'll get out there, and just kind of fell in love. Just as soon as winter hits, it's just like, can't wait for spring to come back around. Just all you can think about is just getting back out on the lake, you know?
Right. It's a very magical place.
Definitely.
If I'm off the water more than like 12, 14 hours, I start getting pretty jittery.
I hear you. Yeah, man. It's people don't quite understand what it's like just living next to a large body of water. I couldn't imagine like living landlocked somewhere.
Right. Yeah. Anywhere else.
Yeah.
When the season gets cold, do you put the jet ski away?
So last year was the first time I bought a jet ski. So relatively newer owner here. And I purposely didn't put it away or winterize it until December, because I took it down to Florida in December just to get one last ride in. That was fun.
Nice.
But that was also took an RV trip down there. But that was back when gas was, you know, $2.20, $2.30 a gallon. Might have to rethink that strategy.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think it actually came down a little bit. I paid $4.77. I thought that was a deal. That's sad.
It's sad. I remember watching them waiting for it to hit 99 cents two years ago. Yeah, other than that, start getting on the lake a lot. Loving it. Currently in the mortgage business. Been doing that for a bit too. That's been a great change in a pace for everything. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. You work for Cross Country Mortgage, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I think, you work with my neighbor, Jerry Godig, which he was on episode 20. I think I sent that one to you. Did you check that out?
Yeah. I watched the whole thing. Yeah. Even if I didn't know Jerry, I'd be sitting on the edge of my seat with that story. Not gonna lie. The whole time I was just like listening, just like, man, it was tight. That was a good, intense episode.
Definitely kind of visualizes what Lake Erie is as a potential hazardous body of water.
Right.
But it's because of Jerry's situation that I prepare so intensely, because before he came on the podcast, I probably heard that story a couple dozen times, you know, over the years. And each time I took a little bit more from it and developed my safety plan and my preparations and everything. Like, for example, I carry a life straw in my kayak. You know, Jerry had to suck on ice cubes. They were getting dehydrated and everything like that. Lake Erie is a fresh body of water. So with a life straw, if I have to, I can survive. I also carry, you know, non-perishable food in there, flare gun, fire starting material. Obviously, I carry a VHF everywhere I go.
Yep.
On the water, that's very important. Do you have a VHF?
I do, and I typically take it out every single time with me, and that was the one time that I left it in the boat versus pulling it over to the jet ski. But, you know, luckily you're right there. I mean, listening to Jerry's story definitely made me rethink my whole strategy too. about just everything, the whole, you know, the whole nine. Hearing that he goes out with extra spark plugs now and extra, you know, extra belts and you name it, he's got his garage on his boat. I mean, you know, right. it really makes you think, like, you know, oh man, if I'm on my way to Put-in Bay and it's 15 miles out, can't see land. Well, you know, what am I going to do? You know?
Right.
So yeah, definitely made me think about it. That's for sure. And make some changes too.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about those changes as well. But why don't we start with, do you want to tell the story? Do you want to tell about that?
Sure. Definitely. So like I said, last year I got my first jet ski. It's a 2015 and it's like an introductory level, performance one. It's a GTR. And I bought it from my boss. It's been awesome. Loved it. And I knew probably like a few months in, I'm like, all right, you know, this thing's pretty sweet. I'm going to order a new one, you know, because they got all the nice features, all the bells and whistles. It's got GPS built into it. It's got radio. It's faster. It's more sporty performance, you could say. And I ordered it back in, I think, October. Or between August and October of last year. And the wait list is just insane because I guess once they close the orders for them, they don't open them back up until the next model year is announced. Right. So like I ordered mine and ended up taking delivery of it in March. It showed up in February, but like it was missing all the electronics because of the chip shortage. So I just had to wait it out. And then I took actual delivery in March, and on the new jet skis, you got to put 5 to 10 hours on them for break-in. First 5 to 10 hours went great. No issues whatsoever. After hour 10, it's when you start getting on it and hammering it more, and no real issues. I got a check engine light, took it back. They cleared it. Some small sensor, nothing, you know, nothing crazy. Took them down to Florida, put another 10 hours on it in Florida, on vacation, maybe a little more, bring it back. First time going back in the water here, launch it hot waters, get out, maybe get out right past the break wall, start heading east. Cause I think the wind was going towards, from west to east. So the waves are just naturally better going east because of the break wall and how everything is lined up. And engine stalled. I'm like, oh man. All right, well, I'll turn back in. So instead of turning around, I was already halfway past the break wall. I was going to take that little, you know,
that cut through.
Yeah, right, that by, cut through there,
the mile long pier.
Yeah, yeah. Got it started back up. Hit the throttle again. Died again. Like maybe, 30, 40 feet. I made it, and couldn't get started back up. So I was like, all right, you know, this isn't good, but all's well. So I was kind of chilled for 3-4 minutes, just waiting for maybe someone to come by, tried to start it again, wouldn't start. And when things went bad and I knew what was happening is when it tossed me off the ski. And the only time, especially on a big 300 horsepower machine like that, the only time you get tossed from it for no reason is if it's taking on water and it's no longer, and you're no longer in, and that center of gravity changes.
Yep.
And at that point I was like, oh crap, you know, this isn't good. And so I get off of it, wait another minute or two, notice it's really not sinking too much. So I just start waving the fender that you got, I get from you. I start kind of waving that around, you know, maybe someone will see me, maybe they won't. And, you know, my phone's in my pocket, it's waterproof. So I was really on the fence. I'm like, all right, do I call 911? Is this, you know, is this a legitimate, you know, all this stuff is going through my head. Like, is this a legitimate emergency? Do I want to take first responders away from somewhere else? You know, like last resort for me is always calling 911. You know, I don't want to be, you know, just last thing. You're always,
you don't want to waste the resource.
Exactly. And I mean, if I didn't see you probably another 3 or 4 minutes and I noticed it was going even more, I definitely would have. But you probably came like within 30 seconds to a minute of me calling emergency services because, you know, pollution, all that stuff. I mean, you just don't want it to sink for no reason, obviously.
Right.
And yeah, you hooked the rope on, started pulling it in. It was funny because as soon as you stopped pulling it to hand it over to Coast Guard and the police, it went down like another 3 feet. Yeah. Like you were keeping it up. And at that point I was like, yep, it's gone. It's done. And so when Coast Guard pulled it in into the docks, I mean, the jet ski itself is 12, maybe 13 feet long. And when they sink upright. So it's going 12 feet down. So dragging it in, the whole bottom got all scratched up, all messed up. And that's actually what totaled it, was the scratches and the damage to the hull.
Right. The structural damage from dragging it, hitting
board. Right. Well, not only that, but I may have the wrong terminology here, but I guess those ones are made out of some sort of ceramic versus a fiberglass. And you can repair them, but the moment that they get in UV sun for more than a few hours, the paint repairs look nothing like they should. And I guess I'll fall back up on that in a second. Anyway, so we get it back to the dock, flip it over, get it back on the trailer, take it to PSJ Power Sports. That's where I get all my stuff done. John's awesome there. And he actually came in on his day off to look at it. And, you know, because if it was savable, we wanted to get it dewatered and everything like ASAP. And he took one look at it. He's like, yeah, we're going to put this off. We're, you know, I don't want to dewater this or anything yet. Let's see what warranty wants to do. Let's see what the insurance company wants to do. Let's not jump the gun on anything. Because realistically, what I'm seeing here, you might not want it fixed. You might have issues down the road. I was like, all right, you know, that's fine. And we were originally going to fix it until Ernie from Salty Dogs. He does ton of vinyl stuff and more cosmetic work to boats. He does really good work. I've had work done by him in the past. And he came by and he's the one who said, like, yeah, this hull's never going to look the same. You know, like, I actually repaired one of these and it delaminated on the bottom and it set and the whole bottom of the hull separated and it launched the guy off the ski because it acted like a giant brake and he broke his ribs.
Oh, wow.
Like, so at that point, you know, insurance society, we're still going through it with insurance, kind of inconclusive, but it's probably just going to get totaled out. So unfortunately, but we did find out why it sunk. Everyone in the world was saying that it was going to be a carbon seal, but it was actually a exhaust flange screw that either never came installed or came loose and was not there.
Vibrated out, maybe.
Maybe. It's hard to say.
You know, it's interesting. The proper thing to do in that type of situation with something that, if it fails, it's potentially a deadly situation, is just a little bit of Loctite, you know, some blue Loctite so that you can actually take it apart if you need to.
Yep.
That would keep it from vibrating out. But the problem is everybody's trying to cut corners nowadays. I mean, I'm not saying this company specifically did that, but it's not the norm anymore for them to put Loctite on there anymore. You know,
right. It's another step out in the manufacturing. It's another cost, you know?
Yep.
Yeah. It's crazy. You know, I think it had 22 hours on it was the total time. Like I said, I mean, I took delivery in March, April. April is actually when I took delivery, beginning of April. I was just going through all my paperwork. it sucks. It's a shame, you know. I mean, I think whenever they're writing up the quotes for insurance, it's a $20 washer and a $20 nut. So $40 worth of cost $20,000 in damage, essentially.
I mean, even further from that, thankfully the water temperature is up right now. But if that would have happened in the fall or early spring, you know, we go out there in dry suits. I'm sure you probably have a wetsuit or something like that. But yep. When you're in that water for a long time, it's going to bring your core down no matter what. I always try to prepare for like a 1.5 to 2 hour minimum response time during the cold water season for the Coast Guard. You know, Coast Guard Lorain shuts down. So we have Marblehead, Detroit, and I think Cleveland.
Yep.
You know, and by the time they get the boat going, get over to your location, hopefully you have the GPS, which the radio that I use, it's a standard Horizon HX890. It has a DSC on it and GPS, so you can look at the face, you know where you're at. There's a man overboard button on the back of it. So if you get in a situation, you can hit that and it'll send your location to the Coast Guard, you know, immediately.
Yeah.
Just a nice thing to have.
Absolutely.
I laugh, but I think I have 6 handheld VHF radios now. So I always carry a spare with me just in case battery dies or something like that. And then the standard Horizon HX890 also comes with a little cartridge where you can put, I think it's AA batteries in the back, you know? So if you get in a situation where your radio does die, I always carry spare batteries with me for that, for my headlamp, for my 360 light in the back. You know, I look at it like this. Once I leave shore, if I don't have it and I need it, I could be in a bad situation. Like I have an emergency bag inside my kayak that never leaves. So there's no potential for me to forget it or anything like that.
Yep.
But when I need that stuff, it's there, you know?
It's kind of mind blowing that the minimum safety requirements set by the laws, really, they're nothing.
Right.
They're nothing. Like as a PWC rider, you're not required to have a flare. You're not required to have anything. I mean, I was 100 feet out from the break wall for 5 minutes. No one knew I was there, you know, in an emergency type situation.
So the cool thing about that, I was out with one of my clients and good buddies, Brad. He had came down to pre-fish because we were tournament fishing for the Lake Erie Walleye Trail the next day. And my friend Irene was coming to meet us after she got off work. So I'm taking Brad to the ramp. I meet Irene halfway to the ramp on the water. Brad says, it's okay. I know where I'm going. You can just go with her. And I decided to, you know, spend a couple more minutes with Brad, make sure he got back to the ramp good. Everything was good and everything like that. And I think that bought me enough time, or bought you enough time, you know, because if I would have just went with Irene, I would have been past you already. But I was trying to make up time, and I was trying to cut through that cut through right there by mile long pier. And there was some guys up there fishing, and they seen you in the water. I pulled up, they said, there's somebody in the water over there. And that's when I started motoring over. And of course, at that moment, I'm motoring full speed to you, and my motor's like, nope, I'm going to shut off.
Oh.
I think my connector was dirty. You know, on those we use like WD-40 just to keep everything clean. There's a lot of electronics, GPS, and you know, if everything's not right, it'll say, hey, you got to check. But that was the worst time. And I remember it died on me, and you're like, hey, can you help me? And
maybe
I'm like, I'm on my way. Motor shut off. Give me 1 second. Yep. Would I have seen you when I came across the wall? You weren't that far down it.
Right.
I probably would have seen you, but maybe I would have taken my time, talked to somebody on the pier. You know, you never know. And being against those walls, especially when the water starts moving, you make one wrong move, bump your head, get pinned between the jet ski. I mean, it is Lake Erie, you know, it's.
Yeah. It turns quick.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. And that's another point that, you know, I kind of learned in that situation was once the bow started coming up on it and it started sinking down, I can't really reach or see any of my emergency stuff in that front hatch.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's why I grabbed the fender instead of the flag, because you know, you can't really right. see anything up there. Just sticking your arm in, grabbing around for stuff.
I almost wonder if maybe it would be beneficial to just make, like, just get a small dry bag, just something small for like that kind of stuff. Where right. if you do get in a situation, you could just quickly grab it off, you know, and yep. be away from the vessel and have what you need.
Exactly. Cause like I said, I didn't know it was this emergency situation until it already threw me off.
Right.
You know, and then, I mean, you can't really climb back on if it's not buoyant and you don't have the right center of gravity on it. It's just going to throw you off again, or you're just going to make the situation worse. So yeah, definitely something like that. Or, maybe just like tying that dry bag to the top of the hatch. So that way, once you open the hatch, you can easily grab it, you know, right. something, just the small things like that. Cause, you know, even if I did have my radio up there, I would have never been able to like find it.
Right.
Maybe by luck, but you know.
So one thing that I do, and I always explain to all my clients, is I tether the radio to my PFD. Couple of reasons. Number one, when I need it, I'm probably away from my vessel. If I just clip it on the PFD, when I fell off, it might have bumped, fell off,
yeah.
floating somewhere, but it's not there when I need it. So I tether it, and that way it's always there. You know, it's just a part of my PFD. You know,
right.
in my PFD, I had that safety knife right there. I have actually an air horn, like just a little pocket air horn, because Coast Guard says you need a whistle. A boat's not going to hear a whistle over their motor. You know, they might hear the right. air horn. Somebody will hear it, hopefully. But it's just trying to dissect that and to take that danger level and prepare for it and bring it down. You know, back in, I think it was 2018, me and a couple of buddies were out off of Avon, and a few hours in, we get a phone call from our buddy Mark. Well, Mark's in the water, and Mark always tests, you know, he always swim tests like most of us do, just to practice and make sure that your skills, when you need them, they're there. So I thought he was just messing around. Well, no, he had developed a crack in his kayak on the top. And after a few hours of just water splashing over, it took on enough water where it threw him off.
Yep.
And now we're 2 miles offshore. We didn't have VHF radios at that time. And we were split up a little bit. You know, we were probably a quarter mile or more away. And, you know, when you get out there, everything kind of looks the same. So
yep.
I got that phone call, and I almost like panic set in, because I'm looking around and I don't know where Mark is. I can't see him. I see a yeah. lot of boats. I don't see Mark, and Mark's in danger. So I pick up the phone. I call up my buddy Jason, and I said, "Hey, Mark's in the water." Well, fortunately, he was, I guess, in between me and Mark. So he actually was able to see Mark, and I seen Jason, and then John was out further. So John basically followed me, and we just kind of followed each other to Mark, hooked up to him, and we had to stop at somebody's private beach and drain it out, because it might have sunk. But you don't think about that until you're put in that situation.
Exactly. And for people that like aren't out on the water, when you're out there like that, you know, mile plus offshore and you see an object out there, you don't know if that's a giant boat. You don't know if that's a jet ski. You don't know if that's a kayak. Like your depth perception and your size perception really gets messed up out there, just because, you know, if a boat's farther away, it could look smaller than a kayak close up. And it's really, it is really hard to tell, you know, like, oh, am I looking at a kayak, my buddy up there on a kayak, or is that a 30 foot boat, you know, just farther away?
Right.
So it can definitely be hard to distinguish things like that. That's for sure.
Yeah. One thing that helps, I don't think it's probably not practical on, you know, a jet ski, but I always have that bright yellow safety flag, and I try to keep it, you know, 5-6 feet off the deck of my kayak. There are days where I'm out in some pretty gnarly stuff that I'm sure I disappear. My flag probably sticking back up. But it creates a different thing for the people to see on the boats. And it's bright enough that it has enough contrast. It's not mistaken for anything else, you know? But with that being said, it's our job to be very visible out there, but just stay out of the way, you know?
Yeah. We're the small guys.
Yeah. Well, you're a little bit faster than us, you know, on the kayaks. I mean, my kayak doesn't move as fast as your jet ski, but it gets going about 7 mph.
Yeah. You get out the way.
Unless I'm towing a sunken jet ski.
Yeah.
I think we hit we're about 2 mph, 1.5 to 2.
You know, it was heavy. Whenever I put it up on the trailer, I was afraid to pull it too far out the water before it drained, because like I could see the trailer bowing. Like it's it had some weight to it, that's for sure. I mean, you know, it's 800-900 pounds dry. So
right. Now, do you carry a hand bilge pump?
I don't, but what I'm going to get is I'm going to get like a, I don't know. I'm kind of undecided on if I'm going to do like a battery powered one or a hand one. I talked to John and I'm like, hey, you know, like if I got a bilge pump on that thing, because jet skis, most of them don't come with actual bilge pumps.
Right.
They have a siphon pump that goes off the jet drive. The problem with them is if you're not moving and you're not powered up, it's not pumping. It's not doing anything. But I asked him, you know, like even if I had a bilge pump, what different, you know, would have I been okay? And he's like, no, you still would have sunk.
Right.
Wouldn't have made a difference. Because the hole that was in it was the size of a baseball, softball. And even if you got 2 1,000-hour bilge pumps, he's like, guess what, your ski still wouldn't have started, because the reason it died in the first place was it was suffocating on its own exhaust.
Right.
So
interesting. One good thing that I just thought of, they have those little devices that you could put in the basement or under the sink or maybe even in the hall, and anytime you get a little bit of water, it'll send an alarm off.
Yeah.
And maybe that'll be like a kind of a like a pre-warning.
Possibly. But I just keep like running through that exact scenario that I went through in my head. And I'm just like, man, I mean, engine won't start, softball size hole in the hull. There's nothing I really I could have bought, done beforehand, or minus taking apart the whole jet ski and Loctite in every single nook and cranny of it. But that's just not practical, you know? So, I mean, in the situation I went through, I just unfortunately don't think that there was any actual way to prevent it. But now I will say for my big boat, my 26 foot boat that I have, that's what I typically take, like the islands, stuff like that, you know, go out with multiple people. I have a extra hand bilge pump. I also got a 12 volt bilge pump and I got a pail. So that way, if I need to start, you know, ditching water, I can any which way possible, you know?
Right.
Because that's you know, having one body in the water is a lot less serious than having four or five, that's for sure.
Right. But, you know, depending on what time of year, I mean, 6 months out of the year, anybody in the water can be pretty deadly. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I think just trying to analyze the situation, I think the best thing to do is just kind of the same thing that us kayak anglers do. You prepare for the swim, you know, you prepare for the water temperatures, because there might be that point where your ski goes down and now you got to rely on what's your backup plan. Like when I go out, I mean, at this point, I know where all the launches are, but early on, I always made sure I had a couple extra rendezvous points, because if the wind changed or the increase, the direction changed, if I couldn't make it back to my launch point, I can just use the wind to my advantage, use the waves to my advantage, and float down there. Eventually, I'll get to land and get off the water, which is important. At that point, then I'll just call a ride or whatever. But having those little, like those things to fall back on, like what happens if your ski does sink? Fortunately, I think you were close enough. You could have probably swam to the rocks right there.
Yeah, eventually. Definitely. I mean, if I started swimming as soon as I got thrown off, I probably would have made it to the rocks before you got there, realistically.
Right.
You know, but I wasn't cold. I wasn't in any immediate danger. So I figured I'd just stick it out, you know, next to it. Just, I mean, if it did sink, I don't want to leave it there, you know.
Right.
Environmental hazard, stuff like that. I was just trying to do everything I could in my power not to have it sink all the way. And I would say, like, the most important thing, have something to make contact as soon as possible. You know, whether that's a radio, a flare, you know, make it known as soon as possible that, hey, there's a situation going on. Because every minute that you don't, that's a minute that someone's not looking for you or someone's not coming to help you. So right. I would say that that's, you know, that's priority number one, is to make it known that, you know, come help, right?
Right.
So have the equipment for that. So that's, you know, radio, flare. I mean, obviously, you know, the GPS radios are by far going to be the best option for that.
Well, there's, are you familiar with the PLBs, the personal locator beacons?
Yeah. I was actually doing a ton of research on them after Jerry's video with you.
Yeah.
He was talking about them.
Those things are a game changer, because radios are great and it should get to the Coast Guard, but it's line of sight.
Yep.
You know, and at least being on a kayak, we're very low to the water. I don't know how far that's actually going to reach if I'm blowing, you know, halfway to Canada. Is it going to reach? Right. I don't know. But the personal locator beacons, they send the signal up to the satellite. So there's no chance for interference. It gets there instantly and they have your location. Like Jerry's situation, if he would have had one of those, he would have been rescued, you know, maybe a few hours after the situation started.
Yep.
But without it, you get in a point where you look around and all you see is open water.
Right. Or fog.
Right. Exactly.
Or
waves.
You know, if it's 2 footers out there, you can't see far if you're down in the water. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever done a simulation with 2-3 footers trying to reboard your kayak, but.
Oh, yeah.
You can't see like past a wave.
No.
You know? Like you can't. Like if you could be 20 feet from your kayak and not know that you're 20 feet from it and think that you're not anywhere near anything.
Right. You know, like, that brings up an interesting point, because depending on who you talk to, some people say you should tether yourself to a kayak. Other people say you shouldn't. I'm a firm believer that any kind of tether like that is just something to get tangled in. If you need to get away from your vessel fast, it's going down. You got to get yourself out of that. You know, with that being said, if you flip over and now you have all these rods dangling around and all these lines, what if you can't get out of the water fast enough? Which I have that NRS co-pilot knife straps right to my PFD. It's blunt on the one side and on the point, so you can actually like push it into your skin and get under whatever's like wrapped up and just cut it. And it's super sharp. I cut your jet ski free two slices, you know, because it was pulling down. I couldn't get it off of the net, so I just cut it.
That was the first thing I said to you. I'm like, hey, man, make sure you can cut this line, because if this thing goes down, it will pull you with it. You know, if you tie it on and you can't get it undone, you're going down with it. So I'm glad. Glad could have made a bad situation worse.
I try to be prepared for everything, you know, but it's situations like this that show you loopholes and stuff like that. Well, like going back to the radio, even if Jerry had one of the handheld radios, which I doubt they had ones with GPS back then.
Right.
But right there attached to your PFD, you have your, you know, your GPS coordinates.
Yep.
That's another thing that I carry
list before any more further trips.
Oh yeah. Another thing that's nice. This is kind of overkill. They make little dye packs, and it's just fluorescent green dye. If the vessel does go down, you're like a needle in a haystack, especially in big water. So you take this dye bag and you open it up, and it just makes this big green blob around you. Obviously you want to wait until you hear the chopper before you open it, because I'm sure it dissipates pretty quick, but it gives them a good target to look for. And it's not something that costs a fortune, you know, they're $4 or $5. I know the jet ski PFDs don't really have any pockets or anything like that. I don't know. Did you take a good look at my PFD?
Not really first on the priority list at that time. Yeah. So I didn't.
There's pockets everywhere and tethers everywhere.
Yeah. I know. I've seen angler, you know, PFDs and stuff, and how those work. They're cool. They're nice.
Yeah. They should have some stuff like that for the jet skis. I know those are kind of designed a little bit different, almost as an impact protection as well, right?
Well, I think, and I could be completely wrong here, but I think the jet ski and like the water sports, those PFDs are more designed for if you get knocked out, that your head's going to be above water facing the right direction, versus other ones where, you know, if you just go limp, you could be face down in the water.
Right.
Because much higher chance of hitting your head doing something like that versus just fishing off a boat or something.
Right. Going 40, 50 mile an hour across the river or across the lake, you know, and hitting one of those trees.
Yep. Anything, you know, flying over the handlebars. You definitely have to know your limits, that's for sure.
Right.
And the ski's limits. So.
That's why I like my kayak. It goes slow enough where it doesn't mind the waves too bad.
Yeah.
It's not like smashing through like the boats and stuff. It's just kind of slow and steady.
Right.
Dragging fish behind.
Heard you had a successful day today, huh? What, 30?
Yeah, it was crazy. I launched early this morning. It was right after sunrise. You know, the fishing was okay. A lot of babies to start off. And then I got to this spot a little bit east. Sometimes it holds bigger fish, especially in the summertime, like when the water starts warming up.
Yeah.
And it actually paid off. I mean, I've been catching 16, 17 inch fish for probably the past few weeks. You know, the babies and the smaller fish are moved in. But I found this pod, you know, and the first one was 25 inches, which it's not a monster, but it's a good eater. You know, it's like 3-15 inch fish, you know, if you look at the meat proportion. And then I got a 24 and, you know, a couple of 18s, you know, nice grade of a limit of fish. And I probably handled 30 or 40. It was just crazy. It was a good day on the water. It wasn't too choppy, a little bit of walleye chop. It wasn't too hot until like near the end, the last couple of hours.
That's another thing. I always carry extra sunscreen. Man, you can get baked.
Oh, yeah. You know, even with the kayak, your legs are basically just sitting there exposed. So you don't really realize how exposed it is until you only bring sunblock.
Right.
And then your knees just get roached. That's why I'm always wearing like fishing pants with the zip off shorts. If I get too hot, I can unzip it, but I have that ability to cover up because it just gets to a point where it lights you up. I've had clients, I always carry sunblock for them. And, you know, most people are like, no, I don't need any. Next day they call me up. They're like, man, I wish I would have taken it sunblock.
Oh yeah. I mean, the sun reflects off the water, then back up at you. I mean, you're getting hit in places you normally aren't with the sun. So it could, burns you quick. That's for sure. That's for sure. Glad you had a good day though. That's awesome.
Yeah. We need to hit the water. You like to fish for muskie and steelhead, you said, right?
That's what I want to learn to fish. I'm more versed in river and pond largemouth, a little bit of smallmouth, but I really haven't started hitting the lake until later in my life. I really never learned to fish the muskie, the steelhead, the perch, the walleye, just nothing I really had to experience yet.
Well, you're in a very good place for it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Probably one of the best freshwater fisheries, definitely in the country, if not the world. I mean, it doesn't matter what you want to chase, steelhead, smallmouth, largemouth, catfish. You go play with the drum if you get bored. They're super fun. Those things fight like crazy. Really. You know, it's not really something necessarily that you're going to go out and target to take home for a meal. There's really not a whole lot of meat on them. But cooked properly, they're not bad. But, you know, it's like, why have the hamburger when you can eat the steak?
Exactly.
So you go out there, you catch the walleye for the dinner plate. Then you have the white bass and the yellow perch, the white perch, catfish, channel cats. This time of year, you can get into long-nosed gar in certain places. Those are a little bit tricky though, because their mouths are so bony. You're not going to, even if they attacked your lure, you're not going to get a good hook set. It's not going to penetrate their, it's just bone. So unless you snag it on a tooth and they don't shake it off, you're not going to catch that fish with that presentation. But what you do is you make your own, it's called a rope fly, and it's just a piece of rope. They have a lot of teeth. They go after that, especially if you do it right. You put a little bit of weight on the front, you make it act, you know, kind of like a minnow, so that they're going to chase it. They come down, they hit that rope, their teeth get snagged in the rope, and then you land the fish.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And we even have, we have bowfin up in Eastern Basin, Mentor Lagoons, areas like that. There are muskie and pike. They're kind of hard to target in the lake though.
Right.
I think it can be done.
West Branch is more known for them. Isn't that right?
West Branch, Leesville. There's a few other really, really nice musky lakes. You know, I was thinking the other day, you probably didn't notice it, but over on at the East 72nd boat ramp, we have a fish cleaning station, and it's like state of the art. It has you stick your scraps in the hole, it grinds it up, takes care of all that for you. And they did that, I think last year they put it in, just to test it, see if it was going to work and everything. And this year, on top of plans to put more in, they put a roof over this thing. So now you can clean your fish in the shade. But not only that, you get hot. We have a ventilation fan up there for you too. And I seen that and I'm like, you know, I don't think there's anywhere else in the world that anglers get treated so good. Oh, it's too hot when you're cleaning your fish at the walleye capital of the world. Just turn the fan on. Keep yourself cool.
Take care of yourself.
Comfortable.
When did they put that whole system in, you said?
The fish cleaning station, I believe it was last year. Or,
you know,
yeah, I think it was 2021.
An indirect thing that happened because of that is now hot water does not smell like rotten fish all the time. Because I don't know if you've ever noticed it during the season, but man, people throw their scraps in that dumpster and it gets nasty.
Oh yeah.
So I guess they're all going there because it hasn't been too bad this year.
Except for last Saturday. Last Saturday it was down there pretty stinky. We did have a lot of northern blows, so there was a lot of fish laying on the boat ramp.
Yeah.
But definitely
that's gotta be what it is people cleaning and just throwing the guts right in the dumpster or something. Because it gets rancid.
Well, the plan, the first one was just a test. You know, they're grinding the stuff up, putting it in the sewer system. They wanted to see how everything was going to work, if it was actually going to be sustainable. And they got everything dialed in. So the plan is to, you know, keep dropping them and providing them along the lakeshore, which is, it's going to keep the fishery healthy. You're not going to have all that scraps and all the stench.
Yeah.
People are going to be happier. You don't have to take that stuff home. And, you know, I throw all my walleye scraps in the compost pile. I try to put whatever I don't eat, whatever I don't use, at least it goes back into the earth. But I know a lot of people have to throw their stuff into the landfill. Well, then that fish is just rotting around the toxic stuff.
Exactly.
It's really not doing anything good. So this it actually gives an opportunity to take that stuff out of the landfill, dispose of it right there. I mean, it becomes fish food basically.
Yep.
You know? It's what they do in salt water. You just scrape it right off, right?
Yep.
Today's podcast brought to you by LakeErieKayakFishing.com. Come along with me and experience one of the best freshwater fisheries in the world while chasing monsters kayak fishing Lake Erie. We now return to the show. One thing I did want to just make sure that we covered on, I know we talked about a lot of different things that you thought about from the situation and all of that. Is there anything that we missed that stands out to you as like a very valuable lesson? Something that you're planning on doing different?
I mean, besides all the safety stuff, you know, just much more awareness on that. Make sure you have good insurance policy, man. You know,
right.
Don't want something silly like that being a financial burden. That's a fact.
Right.
So,
and another good thing to add to that, you know, it's funny. I'm not trying to preach kayak safety to you.
That's all good.
One thing we do is, we leave a float plan, you know, where are you launching? What time you're launching, which direction you're heading, when you're going to be back. You know, if you're not back, if your phone rings, well, you know, the fish are biting. I'll be at, you know, one more cast. It's going to be like four more hours.
Yeah.
But worst case scenario, if you are in danger, they know where to start looking.
Right. Exactly. I would say it's a little bit harder on a jet ski, but definitely not a bad idea. Simply because of the fact of, you know, they can go 60, 70 miles an hour in one direction. So
if you want to
change the course, it doesn't take too long to get 20, 30 miles off your float plan.
Right.
Compared to, you know where the fish go, you know where the fish are biting, you know, you can only go five, 7 miles an hour, you know, a little bit less room for error there. But I mean, any extra safety precaution that you can do is not going to hurt by any means, you know. I would say the Jeep, if you plan on, you know, going out alone on the water in general ever, I would say that the GPS locators are by far your best investment. I mean, for $300 or $400 bucks, it's foolproof. You know, I mean, the only thing you have to worry about at that point is charging it, you know.
Well, I think the personal locator beacons, the battery's good for 5 years, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, at that point,
you can send it in, they'll put a new battery in for you.
At that point, I would say that if you plan on going out on the water alone, I mean, that's your sole best investment.
The question is, you know, what is your life worth? What is it worth to you? What is it worth to the family? You know, your friends and family and loved ones. So people say dry suits are too expensive. The personal locator beacons are too expensive. It's under $1,000. You know, you get a dry suit, under layers, get into it for under $1,000 instead of going out there risking your life and saying that you're not going to go in. Exactly. Or go out there without one of those, you know, and then when you really do need it, just because you wanted to save $400, you know, right, maybe you don't make it back that day.
Exactly.
You know, I think sometimes we just don't think about it like that.
I mean, another way to think about it is if you don't get it and you end up getting hypothermia, you got to go to the hospital, and you do, and you are alive, it's going to cost you a hell of a lot more than $400, that hospital trip. I can promise you that.
You know, we get so dangerously cold so quick. Hypothermia is definitely a danger, but it's the lesser danger because there's a lot of things that happens beforehand. So for example, as soon as you hit that water, anything below like 60 degrees, 50 to 60 degrees, you go through like an involuntary gasp reflex where you can't help it. You just, and you fill your lungs. If you're not wearing your PFD, you just drown, and cold water, you sink, you know, you're not going to float. If you are wearing your PFD, your head probably didn't go underwater. You know, you're probably in a okay situation. You made it through that. Well, now you have 2 to 10 minutes of maximum intensity cold shock where you're just hyperventilating, trying to catch your breath. You can't do anything. You can't try to get back on your boat or your kayak or your jet ski. You're just trying to catch your breath. And one thing that's kind of hidden there is for that 2 to 10 minutes, your core temperature is dropping, you know, and you're starting to get into that hypothermia state and start to lose your dexterity and your fingers and your function. So now you get your breathing under control and you don't have the strength to get back in.
Right.
You know, with that being said, a lot of people try to say, they try to follow the 120 rule. You know, if the air temperature plus the water temperature equals 120 degrees, then you're good. You don't need any thermal protection. But that can't be any further from the truth. If you can't get out of the water, what is the 80 degree air temperature going to do if you're stuck in that 40 degree water temperature?
Right.
Not going to save
exactly.
You.
Exactly. That 40 degrees is no joke. By the way, do you know what the water temperature was that day? I do not.
I think it was like 65 or 66, but I have a picture out. 66.54 degrees.
Okay. Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
No, but if you're in that temperature for hour, 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, the timer starts ticking, that's for sure. I mean, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
One thing that I do want to do is I just want to give you an opportunity to, you know, give a couple of shout outs to the people that take care of you. I know you had mentioned Ernie over at Salty Dogs.
Yep.
If you could just send over those links, I'll drop them in the description so that you know, if anybody needs somebody like that.
Yep. John at PSJ Power Sports.
And it was John at, what was the name of the company?
PSJ Power Sports.
PSJ?
Yeah, PSJ. He's probably one of the best jet ski guys I think he does Sea-Doo and some older Yamahas, but mostly Sea-Doo stuff. He's awesome by far. And myself, mortgages, all about it. I'll send you over my link too.
Yeah, for sure. If you need a mortgage, I'm sure you do refinancing, all that good stuff. Refinance,
purchase, everything. Especially right now with inflation, people consolidating debt, huge thing.
Yep. I'm sure you're familiar with the inflatable PFDs.
Yes, I have a few.
Did you know that there's only one company that sends that product to the consumer or to the store fully assembled? So they put the CO2 cartridge in there, yep. They ship it out and they say, look, it's ready for you. It's going to save your life. That company is Mustang. Mustang deals with all of our first responders and military members and everything like that. So they take everything pretty serious. I'm hoping there's more than just one company, but I know a lot of them, what they do is they drop the CO2 cartridge in the pocket of the PFD.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they do that? Well, you as the consumer, you installed the cartridge. You completed the installation. So the liability is now on you. If that product does not work, it's on you. It's not on the company.
I'm pretty sure Cabela's brands also have it pre-installed.
Yeah.
Cabela's the best pro shop because that's the brand that I own. And it's pre-installed the cartridge.
Nice. I know.
I believe.
I don't think they used to. I mean, this was probably pretty early on. Buddy of mine went, he was duck hunting early October. The water temperature was, just under 60 degrees, probably like 57. And he was out there on his kayak, not with the right gear. And he ended up going in the water. Well, it was just a manual, so you had to pull it to inflate it. He thought he could swim the shore. He got about 30 yards from the kayak, realized he wasn't going to make it to shore. So he started yanking on the thing, and it wouldn't inflate. Well, it was his dad's, and the cartridge never got installed. I don't remember what brand. I thought it was Bass Pro or one of those.
I'm pretty sure Bass Pro and Cabela's were different companies at one point in time. I think they just
back then. Yep.
They just recently, within the past few years, combined. I'm pretty sure that they're pre-installed. But also it could have been another thing where I just did it installed it without even thinking about it too.
Right.
So not 100% on those.
I don't know. For me personally, I look at it like this. You're taking something like a regular standard conventional PFD is going to work no matter what.
Yep.
If you get a hook in it, you stab it, you snag it on something, it looks like crap, but it's going to float you. Those inflatables, you're taking something that is a life-saving device and you're like, well, maybe I don't need it that much because you're adding that failure factor. And I mean, I guess it really depends on what your comfort level is and what you value your life at.
I would say that the inflatables are better than nothing.
Absolutely. If you're not going to wear anything, an inflatable is way better than that.
Yeah. So like what I normally do whenever I go fishing is I wear the inflatable and then I have a real one there as well.
Right.
But just for comfort, stuff like that personally, the inflatables to me would be fine. If, I fall in or I really need to use it, always grab the other one. Like a kayak or something like that. Obviously, if it's a boat and you leave it in there, that's not going to work. But better than nothing.
Anything is better than nothing for sure. Wearing nothing and maybe having the PFD within reach, that puts you in kind of a sketchy situation.
Oh yeah.
I don't think most people think about it. One day I tried it. Walking the boat ramp without your PFD. just throw it out there, walk out to it while you're trying to swim, hold yourself above the water and try to put it on.
Oh, it's not easy. It's difficult.
It's like very, it's almost impossible.
I think a lot of people too, you know, they don't openly swim in Lake Erie, but they openly swim in Florida or North Carolina or anywhere there's salt water. But I don't know the exact percentage, but it's definitely between like 15 and 25% more buoyant you are in salt water. Right. And that little bit, that makes a huge difference. You know, that takes a 200-pound person and makes it feel like they're, you know, 160 or 170 pounds. That's 30 extra pounds that's dropped off you in salt water versus fresh or whatever the exact numbers are. But you know, that it's almost, it'd be the same as strapping 30-pound weights to your ankles and going to try and swim in salt water. That's what it's like swimming in fresh, and people don't realize that. It's a huge, huge difference. And you know, people that live around here, you know, a lot of them don't go that deep in fresh in Lake Erie to realize that, compared to, you know, like the beaches down south or salt water. So
that's interesting. I did not know that.
Really? If you got your computer there, look up how much more buoyant you are in salt water, what the percentage is.
1.6 pounds more buoyancy in salt water than in fresh. That means if an object with a volume of 1 cubic foot weighs 63 pounds, it will float in salt water and sink in fresh water.
Yeah. So I don't know what the mass of the human body is versus that and that, and what the actual weight difference is, but there's a noticeable difference.
I'm going to drop that link in the description as well for anybody that wants to check that out. That's interesting. You know, I haven't really spent a whole lot of time in salt water. I've only been to Florida once. I fished Matt Lachey right there for speckled trout and mangrove snapper and snook. And then I fished Chesapeake Bay for striper, for the Ocean Run striper. But that's the extent of my salt water.
Yeah.
After, you know, the fall brawl is going to end the end of November. And then I really don't have anything until probably February. Am I going to have people come out in the winter? Some people are as crazy as I am. Not everybody has dry suits though. And I'm trying to figure out the equation. What sizes do you buy? How do you know who's going to come out? Right. And it's a big investment too. So what do you buy? Definitely. You buy 5 suits, you know?
Well, and then with dry suits, you got to worry about people getting hooks stuck in them and stuff like that. You know, they're not as foolproof as the wet suits.
As a matter of fact, my third trip out in my dry suit, fortunately it was on the way back in. Now I put all my treble hooks away before I get out of my kayak, but I got out of the kayak and the treble hook went right through my brand new suit.
Yep.
Fortunately, there's a Aqua Seal, works really good. You just put tape on the outside, put a little bit of Aqua Seal on the inside. You don't even know it's there. If you need instant on the water repair, there's Aqua Seal Instant, I think UV. So that'll actually set up instantly and you'll be watertight. That's something good to carry offshore. Because you're 2 miles out, you get a puncture. You want to go in, or do you want to continue fishing? You know.
Yeah. Well, that too. Yeah.
And you do have to worry about like your wrist gaskets and your neck gaskets and your zippers. The zipper is the most expensive part on the dry suit to replace, because that zipper has to seal. If you get sand and grit and dirt and stuff in there, eventually it's not going to seal very good. That being said, I've had my Kokatet, it's the Hydrus Supernova Angler. I've had that since, I think this is the end of the 5th season. Well, it was. We're going into the 6th season.
Yeah, and nice.
no issues. And honestly, like I don't take care of it. Up until this year, I didn't take care of it. I just roll it up, throw it in the back of my trunk. Always have it with me, you know, that way you don't get to the water and, oh, where's the dry suit? Well, it's at home. Guess you're not going fishing. I've never had any issues with it. You know, the wrist gaskets are starting to get a little dry, but I haven't treated them. You're supposed to put 303 protectant on the cuffs. Just once or twice a year, just enough to keep that latex pliable, you know. But if you do rip it, I think there's $60 for the set. So it's not a real hard repair. I think you use AquaSeal on the inside. Because that's something I thought about too, is like, okay, well, I invest all this money hoping that I get the right people that fit into these suits. What's going to be the maintenance? You know, what am I going to have to spend for that stuff?
I mean, those would be a lot easier to take care of because, you know, you have a special spot for them. You're not going to use them all the time. As long as you have a regular like maintenance schedule, you know, in January and in June, you're going to go and, you know, put the sealant stuff on them.
Right.
And I mean, because I know wetsuits are very particular on sizing because, you know, if you have too much slack in it, you're not going to stay warm because it's not going to keep that buffer of water on your skin. Are dry suits as important to have the right sizing as wetsuits?
Well, with the dry suit, it's going to keep you dry. It's not going to keep you warm. So it's not like the wetsuits where it traps the layer of water and you kind of have like that blubber layer there. The dry suit is kind of like your outer shell. And what you do underneath your outer shell is what's important. So you layer it. I guess you
could probably just get a few universal sizes, no? Probably make them work.
Maybe. That's kind of the direction I was thinking. Maybe get a size bigger. You know, if they have a little extra room, at the end of the day, it's not going to matter. They can burp. Right. We can burp the suit. So they're not going to have that issue. Plus, they'll have the PFD on as well. It might just, they might be swimming in it a little bit, but with the right underlayers, they're going to stay warm and the dry suit's going to keep them dry.
Right. And hopefully they don't have to.
Well, they do have relief zippers in the front. So it's not like a wetsuit where you got to pee in the suit. Now, with that being said, everybody leaves the relief zipper open until they go in and test and realize they left it open. And then it's the first thing you check every time.
Yep. Oh, I'm sure. It's a great surprise.
But I think it's a valuable offering to the community because a lot of people, they're curious. Do I want to mess with cold water? Do I want to invest all this money into all this gear?
Right.
Well, if I have it as an offering with the right gear, they could come out, learn how to do it right, do it correctly and safely, and see if it's for them, you know. Absolutely. Without investing all that money.
Because once you start getting into like merino wool, all the expensive, the lightweight base layers, I mean, not only are you going to be almost $1,000 for a nice dry suit, but you know, your underlayers are going to be up there too. So I can definitely see how that's an appeal.
There's a little bit of a hack for underlayers, mainly because they're under the dry suit. Who cares what they look like, if they're stained, if they have a little bit of a rip or something like that. Every once in a while, I'll go to a thrift store or Goodwill, something like that, and you walk down and you look for that, the merino wool sweaters.
Yep.
Or the polyester pants, just that kind of material, because it might be a little bulky than what you need, but if you don't have $800 to spend on extra underlayers, this will get you by, you know.
Exactly.
Spend the money on the dry suit, the underlayers. Who cares if this $80 sweater has a little hole in it? You know, it's going to keep you warm. And anything merino wool is amazing. Oh, but yeah. You layer it, you know, you start with your base layer, which is just like a thermal layer. And then you go with the mid layers, which is your merino wools and your polyesters, just a little bit thicker, a little bit more insulation. And then the outer layer is the dry suit.
Yep.
And there's a couple different kinds of dry suits. There's a bunch of different companies, but you have what's called a semi dry suit and you have a regular dry suit. The difference is your latex neck. On a full dry suit, it has a latex neck. That's very important for like divers, you know, in dry suits, or the whitewater guys that are always rolling and flipping and going under the waterfalls and stuff like that.
Right, where it's guaranteed you're getting wet.
Right. You don't want anything pushing down on the neoprene on like the semi-dry suit. What I have basically just has a neoprene neck gasket that cinches down. If you go completely under the water, you might get a dribble or two back there. You have the right underlayers. They're still going to keep you warm, even with a little bit of sweat, a little bit of water. So it's not a problem. And you probably haven't seen any of my swim videos, have you?
I dabbled around a few of them, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
I
saw you dunk out in some 40-degree water.
Did you see the one where it was all frozen?
No, I didn't. I'll have to check that one out.
So this was December 26th. I remember because nobody would come testing on Christmas Day. You know, I didn't have my daughter, so I'm like, let's go dry suit testing. They're like, let's go tomorrow. I said, it's going to be 0 degrees. It's going to be frozen.
Perfect.
Fortunately, it wasn't, but it was slushy. I mean, I couldn't even get the kayak through it. But the idea of that test was, can I fall out of the kayak 2 miles offshore, get back in, and still stay warm enough to get back?
Right.
Am I going to eventually get too cold? So we went in those conditions and then just hung out outside, let everything freeze. I was probably outside for the next 2-3 hours. My PFD, I had to like squeeze over my head because the zipper froze. My beard was froze, but I was warm. My core was warm. My layers did exactly what they were supposed to do. And I knew for a fact that when I go out there by myself, like I often do in the middle of winter, I'm going to be able to protect myself and take care of myself because at the end of the day, it's my job to save my own butt out there. By the time somebody else shows up, it might be too late. So I need to prepare for that.
So my question for you is, if you do fall off in the middle of January, February, when, you know, the lake's at its coldest, and you're able to get back on, are you still calling for help or you think you're good?
Well, are you in a dry suit or not?
Oh, yeah.
If you're not in a dry suit, you're calling for help. If you're in a dry suit, it's a normal day because we test them often.
All right.
That's just, it's something that you should do at least once. You need to know how your body's going to react to that temperature. For example, on that day where everything was frozen over and the air temperature with the wind chill was 0 degrees, or it was like one situation that I never dealt with in any of my testing previously, happened in this instance. And it was because of that low air temperature. So when you go, you put your head underwater and you're not protected with like a neoprene barclava or something, or barclava. We'll call it a barclava.
Okay.
And what happens is, as soon as you hit that water, your brain's like, whoa, reset. I mean, that's your central nervous system. And you just put it in 30 degree water and you popped out, and now you're in air temperature with a wind chill of 1. It took me a second. I mean, I've been in that situation.
Colder than the water.
Yeah. And it instant brain freeze, you kind of lost your focus. And it's funny, you know, I didn't really fully understand the lesson until I did a podcast episode for ladies, for cold water safety. You know, I had a lot of lady anglers that were looking for some knowledge that was kind of lady specific. So I put together this round table just of a bunch of different ladies in different aspects of the sport. And my one buddy is Moulton Avery. He's the founder and director of the National Center for Cold Water Safety. Mm-hmm. So I brought his wife on. I mean, it's only right, you know. She's obviously well-versed in all that stuff, being married to Moulton. And she was telling me about a story where every time they go out, they flip over, they roll, you know, they're in sea kayaks. So they go out there and they roll, they test their gear. But they do that before they venture out. Well, this day she gets out there and she's rolling, or she goes to roll. And as soon as her head hit the water, she let go of her kayak. Cause you got to hold yourself in when you go upside down. She let go of the kayak and she came out, and Moulton's like, "What happened?" She's like, "I don't know." Well, when she told that story, the light bulb went off, because I know what I went through, but I didn't fully understand it until she told her story. And you know what happened? As soon as her head hit that water, the brain went into reset. It's not thinking about staying in that kayak. It's just in shock from that temperature.
Right.
So, I mean, dry suits are great. Headgear, I don't know. The best way is to get some gear, get out there and test it. Everybody's body's different.
Yep.
You're going to need different underlayers. You're going to need different underlayers depending on what the air temperature is, and the water temperature. You don't want to overdress and then overheat yourself. Putting yourself in that type of dangerous situation. And the other thing is preparing for the extreme air temperature. The water temperature is not going to get any colder than 32 degrees or you're walking on top of it. But the air temperature, you can get pretty dangerous if you're out there on, you know, when the water is not frozen, but the air is 10 degrees.
I mean, wind chill alone can, you know, swing in another 20 plus degrees.
Yep.
Easily, especially out on the lake with no obstacles.
That was one thing that was going through my head, because I had swam a couple of days earlier. It was, remember we had that heat wave. It was so hot. First thing I did was swim. So I knew the water temperature wasn't going to immediately like kill you, but I knew you were kind of in danger a little bit as far as the water temperature for hours. 65, right. 66 degrees. I don't know what the real number is, but I'm sure after an hour or two, that's going to drop your temperature. I don't know, 10 degrees. That it might be enough to.
It would have to at a certain point. I'm sure it depends on, I'm sure a lot of factors depend at that temperature. You're kind of on the border of, you know, cold, right. And you're kind of on the border of, you know, safe water temperature versus a hypothermic, very dangerous water temperature.
Right. Yeah. Anything under 60 degrees is definitely very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
But even this, I mean, you think about it, it was starting to get dark. Once the sun goes down on Lake Erie, it gets pretty cold, especially the wind kicks up and you're wet.
Oh yeah. It'll be, it could be 75, 80 degrees on mainland and then, you know, 50 on the lake at night. There's nothing there.
I'm going to do some research and find out about that. How long can you survive in 65 degree water?
Look up, find out the exact buoyancy difference too on salt versus fresh for how much you weigh and how big you are.
Yeah. I'm going to put that, I'm going to post that in the links or post the link in the description as well. I thought it was cool. I thought it was cool how we met, you know,
don't meet too many people like that.
No, And I remember when I told you to jump on the front of my kayak. And
I was like, you sure? I don't know.
I mean,
I don't know about that.
They will handle the weight. But in that type of situation, trying to tow, it probably wouldn't have been good, especially because it was pushing the bow down in.
Yeah.
Which
now, if the water was like 40 or 50 degrees, then that'd be the move.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to do when you had to get off the bow of the kayak, I was thinking, well, where can you go? You know,
yeah.
If you need to get out of the water. Well, the back compartment's pretty big. But I do have a bunch of fishing poles with a bunch of treble hooks and stuff. So I was thinking, where am I going to put those? Well, I went back to my lure wraps. You know, I used to always keep lure wraps on them. And in that situation, that would have been a game changer, because you could have got on the bow or on the stern right there in the tank well, and the boat would have handled it. And yep. I wouldn't have had to worry about you getting a treble hook.
Right.
But that's the downside of these fishing kayaks on Lake Erie. I guess if there is a downside, is we have to carry so much stuff to target the walleye and just be consistent. Where do you put somebody in that situation? I don't know. That's one of the biggest things that I took away from the situation is, what if this was winter? How would I have gotten you out of the water? You know, and that's something that I'm still trying to figure out.
I couldn't imagine, you know, you definitely have a Titanic moment there.
Yeah. Well, another thing that I carry, which is pretty cheap and compact, is one of those space blankets. You know, it's kind of like aluminum foil, thin, but it reflects the body heat in. So worst case scenario, if you need to strip them down, put that on, during the cold months, I always carry an extra dry bag, with all kinds of different clothes, you know,
right.
Sweatshirts, pants, socks, hat, gloves, just something like if I come across somebody not prepared in that situation.
Not to mention, though, I mean, if that was in middle of winter and if it was life or death of getting someone on the bed, you'd start throwing gear. You right. Start, you know, you start ditching gear and you know, it is what it
for
is.
For sure, for sure.
And then you got the room to do it too, so.
Right. Yeah, that wouldn't even be a thought at that point.
Right, right, right. But, yeah, I think that pretty much covers it for me.
Awesome. Devin, it was great talking to you. Cool. Awesome, man. Thanks for your time, brother.
For sure, Chuck. We'll be in touch.
All right. Talk to you later.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the show. Don't forget to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast listening app. We will see you on the next episode. And remember, for me, fishing is life.